You're listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
Because we're joined by the one and only Chloe Swarbrick. Kia ora, Chloe.
Kia ora, mate. I was going to say, mostly because Elliot Blythe's hosting the show.
Stop it.
Look, flattery first, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's what it's all about. Chloe is the co-leader of the Green Party, also the MP with the most Instagram followers.
Oh, true.
Yeah. Now that Jacinda Ardern's not there, you take the cake.
It's that easy if the people who are above you leave.
Exactly. That's what it's all about. We're going to be talking all sorts of things, like renting, like the new climate change legislation out.
So-called strategy.
So-called
the emissions
strategy.
Reduction plan as put out today, which shows that we are now demonstrably off track to hit our climate targets in 2050.
Which is pretty awful. I'm not excited about that. But
really
it gives us lots to talk about.
It does mean that people should know about it. So you know what? Education is power. Stand up, fight back, etc.
So true. So we're going to go to that. Also, at 8 o'clock, we have an interview with Purple Dog, the hottest Dunedin band on the scene. I don't know if I can say they're the hottest. They're one of my favourites for sure. They're a lot of fun. As well as at 8:30, we're going international for a section where we're talking to a French person in Greenland, of all places, about the French election. But first, let's play some music. We will be talking about renting, and so what better band to discuss the renting situation here in Aotearoa than Darts? This is Flat Inspection. You're on the one.
My landlord, he fell down the stairs during our flat inspection. He should have done all the repairs that I've counted.
That's, what is that song called? That's called 40 Rutherford Street by Darts on Radio 1. It's Sustainable Sounds, and I'm here with Chloe Swarbrick.
Kia ora.
We were just discussing just during that song about how you got onto radio, because you were on BFM back in the day. Tell us
number
about that.
Number one alternative radio station in Auckland.
Number one in Auckland.
I was at B for about 4 years. Time of my life. And shout out to the Student Radio Network.
SRN.
I'm probably not giving all too much away, but when we were in conversations, because obviously in the first term in 2017 to 2020, I was our broadcasting spokesperson, so I was in a lot of conversations with Chris Farfoy about the then proposed TVNZ RNZ merger. And I remember going into the first few meetings with him like, what if we took that money and we invested it in independent radio? Because, it's the breeding ground for some of the best talent in this country. And I also love how it's such an amazing platform for local musicians.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, I think the Dunedin band scene at the moment is in one of the best places that it's ever been.
True.
Yeah, honestly. Like,
big call from Elliot Blythe.
Well, okay, I would say up there with the Dunedin sound. Like when I was in high school, there was a pretty big range of bands and they all had a really particular sound, but now I'd say there's maybe double the number of bands on the scene that I'm sort of in the loop of. Maybe it's just me, maybe I'm more in the loop.
Extrapolating from your life experience.
Exactly.
But look, I mean, everyone does that, right?
Yeah.
That's cool. No, hype it up, man. I think that, we should all be very excited about the cool things that are happening in our communities. That actually just sprinkles me into this other random, but totally somewhat related parallel thing.
Yeah.
I was at this ETU conference, one of the many unions in this country, last week, and I got up just after somebody had been, recounting all of the awful things that the government had done through, the proposed amendments to whittle down rights that had been won by contractors through the likes of the Uber drivers case, and getting back to 90-day trials and things like that. And I was like, man, there's a real down buzz in the room. And I got up and I was like, who here is excited about the future? And three people in a room of 150 put their hands up. And I was like,
I think
this is pretty indicative of the problem that we're facing, right? Like, we don't seem to currently have all too much of a unifying, creative and exciting vision for the future that we all want to rally behind.
Yeah.
And when we come from that place, we are therefore operating from defensiveness, and that's where we're most weak. We're, divided, we fall.
True.
So I guess this is connected to the Dunedin music scene. By virtue of when you connect the dots on how many amazing people are doing this stuff and you get behind them and you advocate for it, the inevitability is it grows bigger and bigger.
True. And so it's the Dig the Gig competition is tonight, which is pretty crazy. The winner of Dig the Gig gets a recording contract in LA, baby. Which is crazy. Sounds like a plot from a movie, but
that is
the truth. It's a semi-final tonight, and there are a lot of great bands playing it, including Leo Lilly, The Beatniks, Cruise Control, Ani Safa, and a few others. We might get to play some on the show later on. And Leo Lilly and the Beatniks are also playing another gig tonight as well, which is crazy.
Wait, back-to-back gigs?
Yeah. Yeah, man. And one of the people in the Beatniks is also in two of the other bands in Dig the Gig. So they're playing, like, the whole night.
Back-to-back-to-back. Exactly. Yeah. Don't let anyone in this government talk down to the creatives for not being hard-working men.
Exactly, yeah. Well, I was going to say, talking about the optimism, are you optimistic about the future? Are you excited about the future?
I'm excited about the future that we can create together, for sure. But I don't think that precludes us from being able to also, you know, offer substantive critique to the way that things are at the moment.
Definitely.
I just don't want it to get in the way of us working together to actually be like, you know what, we can leapfrog all of this depression and exhaustion and angst and anger, which is understandable and totally rational in the context of what's currently happening.
Definitely.
Let alone the economic realities which have been playing out for 40-odd years.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do, like, a lot of younger activists in particular tend to ask me, you know, how I retain a sense of hope, or like what keeps it sustainable to continue doing activism and advocacy. And I think definitely holding true to and knowing really clearly what it is that we're actually fighting for, not necessarily positioning or defining ourselves by what we're fighting against, because that, again, I'd argue is coming from kind of a place of weakness. But it is also about finding joy.
Yeah.
We get to have fun. Yeah. And fun is necessary.
So true.
Arts are necessary for us to, I don't know, communicate and express ourselves and connect with other people in a way that, yeah, just constantly coming from this space of needing to fight for our very survival, let alone our thriving, does not.
For sure. So what is your vision then? What is the fun? What is the future we're building towards?
It's a future where everybody has what they need, not only to survive but to thrive. So what that looks like is livable incomes for all, whether people are, you know, working in the way that we currently conceive of working, or contributing or participating in their community in ways that we don't currently value. And I mean, it could go on a massive diatribe about feminist and well-being economics here. But effectively, it does look like livable incomes for all.
For sure.
Looks like living within our planetary means, and it also looks like all the more local. So people being empowered to genuinely make decisions about what's happening within our communities. And I find such a deep irony in here to connect the dots between some of the things that the government's doing, the potential that we have to make local decisions, and what's currently in the biscuit tin from a member of this government. We had a proposal, I think, just released
into the
biscuit
tin,
last week.
Just to clarify.
The biscuit tin is a hallmark of Aotearoa New Zealand's interesting democracy, in which members that are not ministers, whether they be government or opposition, are able to put their ideas for laws into a very literal biscuit tin, or rather the chips which represent the numbers associated to those bills, and they are drawn out like a lottery, because, you know what, that's how we do democracy around these
days. Democracy at random.
And one of those members from the government benches has put forward a bill to remove from the RMA, or rather to prohibit in the Resource Management Act, local authorities' ability to consider climate change in consenting projects.
Yeah.
This is just like such a classic example of the nonsense that we're up against, right?
So, definitely.
Yeah, I guess my point is we can be really clear about the things that are gnarly and terrible, but we also need to realise that the people who are being turned off by an agenda from this government, which, you know, is absolutely shredding progress for people and planet, are not the people who are winning under that agenda. So if you catch my drift, those of us who are currently looking at what's happening and going, that's exhausting, don't want to touch politics with a barge pole, are precisely the people who need to be engaged, because the people who are getting their wish lists from lobbyists ticked off are sweet with the way that things are going. Yeah. And that's kind of the perversity of the way that politics has operated, I think, for most of our lifetime, is that we have seen politicians not do things that we believe in or that we think are good or conducive to all of our well-being.
Yeah.
And in turn, we switch off. But that only tends to concentrate more power and wealth in the hands of the people who already have it.
Yeah.
So the story here, Elliot Blythe, is that what we need is all of us to come together to be really clear about our values and to explicitly talk about the vision that we have together, and then to work for that thing.
Yeah, definitely. I love that. What a beautiful answer. And I was going to say, on the people who are not on board with this government, the critic is back for semester two, which is fantastic, because I was missing it. But they have in the latest edition the census, and in the critic census it says that I think it's 7.6% of people think that the current coalition government are doing good things.
7.6?
Yeah.
Amongst the student body?
Amongst the student body.
Is this, like, statistically legit, or is this just a random grab bag of...
It's somewhat legit. Sorry, I'm just pulling up the figures here.
Let's get to the evidence, right to the source, man.
Yeah, it's as I quickly rifle through the pages of this beautiful magazine. You actually,
that's great. You're doing ASMR.
Thanks. Yeah. feel that. You get a call out in here actually as well.
Oh, true. A call out. Am I being called out or called in?
A shout out.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, they're saying the Green Party received 57.8% of the popular vote in the critic census.
Oh, man.
And it says it's unclear whether Green Party Chloe leader Chloe Swarbrick
Chloe leader
we're getting there. It's unclear whether Green Party co-leader Chloe Swarbrick's Muay Thai skills contributed to her wooing the youths. What was that all about?
That's to do with an interview that I did with former critic editor Fox, who is actually now in the parliamentary press gallery for Newsroom, which is pretty buzzy. I walked into the office down there the other day and he was sat in there. And I believe in that interview, I don't even know what the question was, but all roads led back to the fact that I did about 2.5 years of Muay Thai, and I was going to do competition.
What is Muay Thai?
Muay Thai is Thai kickboxing.
Okay.
Yeah, so think of boxing, but cooler. You got knees, you got elbows, you got grappling around the back of people's necks to throw said knees into faces.
Yeah,
not necessarily explicitly in keeping with the Green Party's kaupapa of non-violence, but, you know...
We've got to let it out somewhere, right? Definitely. No, that is fantastic. Hey, let's go do a little bit of music. Do you want to talk about the song Wet?
Oh, yeah, cool. So this, I just think that we were like kind of in a vibe of New Zealand music. There is a lot of New Zealand music, as it transpires, that is about shitty flats.
Yeah.
This is one such song.
I wonder why there are so many songs about that.
This one is actually a fascinating intersection not only of a terrible flat, but also of the Auckland anniversary flooding and what occurred to said flat, which is inhabited by my good friend Lucy, who is the front woman of this band, Dick Move. The song is called Wet.
Lovely. Here it is on Radio 1. That was Same Thing by Church. That's some loud background music.
From a great new album called I Heard You Can Talk to the Dead at Trust Stadium. Just another awesome Tamaki Makaurau Auckland artist for you, Elliot. I'm just trying to put them on your radar.
Yeah, one by one we'll get there. Is Trust Stadium a stadium in Auckland?
Trust Stadium's out west. Yeah.
Okay, yeah nice. The Green Party has just launched their, or not just launched, but has launched
In the last few weeks.
Campaign about renters. Tell us about it.
So you may have noticed that we have a big problem with housing in this country, and approximately a third of people who live in those houses are renters. So there's around 1.5 million renters in this country. Obviously, we're still yet to get the most up-to-date stats because we are waiting on census data, which will be rolling out over the next few months. But what we know from StatsNZ data from 2018 is that those renters are likely to spend more of their income, disproportionately more than those who own an occupy for older, colder, and mouldier properties that are more inclined to make them sick.
Lovely.
So it's a terrible state of affairs, but again, much like I was alluding to before, the status quo doesn't come from nowhere. It's not inevitable. It's not something that we have to accept. It is the consequence of political decisions that have been made to this day. So different decisions can be made to fix it.
Although I think it's sort of an interesting dynamic here in Otago where there is almost an expectation that, you know, you do your year in your shitty flat, and that's just part of it, which is so interesting.
It's really messed up, man. And it's interesting because I was our tertiary education spokesperson for the Greens for 6 years prior to this most recent term, and our renter spokesperson for the last three years as well. It very much is related to, in terms of your point around like people doing the time in their terrible flat, but also this notion that poverty is almost a rite of passage. And I've got a number of things to say about that. The first is, what's the point of society evolving if that is your argument? But secondly, it's just not the truth anymore. It isn't a kind of a moment that you pass through. And if you are what some may conceive of as being poor for an extended period of time, you are living in poverty. That is not just being broke. That is, living in a situation in which you are not able to afford all of the basics, which ultimately is detrimental to your physical and your mental well-being. And that actually is also all intrinsically related to mental well-being, right?
Yeah, definitely.
So part of the campaign that we've kind of pulled together is helping people to, I guess, look above the day-to-day kind of circumstances that you can kind of almost take for granted, as you're alluding to, that you just think that it's this normal thing that everybody has to go through, and instead realize that these are systemic issues that are facing all of us.
Yeah.
And we already know that by virtue of the systemic disempowerment that is facing renters, which this government's agenda is continuing to entrench even more so through the likes of no-cause evictions, which undermine every single other right that renters ostensibly have, let alone, you know, the ability to have rental increases only once per annum or so, or the fact that they're supposed to be set at what is supposedly market rent, but who determines market rent landlords and
it's
property managers.
It's that meme of like Chris Luxon saying the market determines the market rate, and then it's like the market
he
and
is,
it's just like seven.
Yes, a landlord who owns seven houses.
Yeah.
I think that the average amount of properties owned by cabinet ministers in this government is 2.5 or so.
That's crazy.
And you can fact check this by going to the pecuniary interests of all members of parliament. You can just Google that and you will see all the things that everyone owns.
Yeah, wow.
But yeah, like the point of this campaign was to flip the script, because frequently whenever we're talking about advocating for changes in the rental market, you will hear this bizarre kind of pushback that apparently advocating for renters' rights and to stop people getting sick in homes that they are paying an arm and a leg for is apparently a war on landlords. And apparently we're supposed to think of those landlords as mums and dads who are just, you know, I don't know, saving their nest egg or whatever.
Yeah.
First thing I'd say is that if those mums and dad landlords are the very ones who are responsible for people living in terrible circumstances, maybe we shouldn't feel sympathy for that caricature. But secondly, landlords represent approximately 2% of the population. We don't actually have good data on this because both Labour and National have refused to engage in collecting that data.
Really?
But this is the best that we can get from kind of gleaning from MB Bond Lodgement data, from Statistics New Zealand, and from the company's office and Land Information New Zealand records. So approximately 2% of the population are landlords.
Yeah.
But approximately 33% of the population are renters.
Yeah.
And there are increasing numbers of New Zealanders who are having to rent for life. I believe it was the Retirement Commissioner who came out about a year ago and said that it's looking as though a quarter of the retired population now rent as well. So it's no longer, given the state of affairs in this late-stage capitalist world, in which renting is seen as a stepping stone.
Yeah.
So even though we shouldn't accept that if it were a stepping stone that people should live in diabolical circumstances, given that it now looks to be the trajectory of many people, including mums and dads, we should do something about it. So the point of the campaign is to get as many people as possible to tell their stories, which gives power in numbers and a critical mass in which people can understand, normal, regular people can understand their shared power and that you're not alone in experiencing these kinds of things. But also, if we get your permission, we can then pitch these stories to the media so that we are providing a counterbalance to the nonsense that we're hearing out of some politicians at the moment who are arguing against better standards for renters.
Yeah, definitely. I had I used to live on Knox Street, just on the other side of the gardens from here, and I was just catching up with a friend earlier today who said someone else who lived on Knox Street got permanently sick from, like, you know, years ago they lived on Knox Street and are still sick to this day.
Rheumatic fever is a classic example of that at its most extreme. Yeah, people can be on medication for life to deal with that, and these are people's homes, something which is supposed to be a human right. And this isn't some woke kind of culture war nonsense.
My woke opinion is that people should live in houses.
Crazy, man. But in the after the World Wars, the world came together, jurisdictions, countries like ours came together and said, hey, let's try and prevent atrocities like that ever happening again.
Yeah.
How do we do that? We're going to create this entity called the United Nations, and we're going to decide what we think are foundational rights that all human beings are entitled to in order to prevent conflict ever escalating to that point.
Yeah.
Housing was one of those fundamental human rights.
Yeah.
Yet we have seen through reforms through the 80s, 90s, and through to today that that social contract has been shredded.
Yeah.
And that's the other really key point that I want people to understand is, like, this stuff is not inevitable.
Yeah.
It happened because politicians decided decided that they would sell renters down a river and allow very few people at the top of the pecking order to make more and more money.
Yeah.
Like, at a time when the average person is struggling with the cost of living, those on the NBR rich list made, I believe, and I will fact check this, I think it was $20 billion more in a year.
Crazy.
That's it's cookery, crazy. Man, yeah. But it's not inevitable.
Yeah, because there are also international examples where things are not so bad, right?
Yeah. Oh, my Lord. If we want to go to Europe, if we want to go to rent controls. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, even rent controls are a really classic example, because I raised the specter of this. I started talking about rent controls in the context of Aotearoa about 3 or 4 years ago, and it scared right-wing think tanks like the Taxpayers Union, and I've forgotten the name of the other one off the top of my head, but they put out this supposed thought piece, or, you know, paper, where they started citing all of these examples where they were saying that things have gone terribly wrong as a result of rent controls.
Yep.
But if you delved into the detail and the citations of what they were talking about, they were actually talking about areas where, for example, rent controls were removed and then rents escalated rapidly, and their justification was that that was a distortion to the market.
Hmm.
And our basic premise is that perhaps we shouldn't be treating something which is a human right as a commodity.
Yeah.
So rent controls actually do currently exist in the Residential Tenancies Act in the form of, currently, the ability to increase rents no more than once per year.
Yeah.
And also, as I was alluding to before, they can be no more than what is determined to be the market rate.
Yeah.
The problem with the market rate is that obviously it's a self-fulfilling prophecy based on those who have all of the power in that market, i.e. landlords, to do things like price fixing, which is illegal in other other areas in the economy.
But also the raising the rents once a year thing is also a little bit of a moot point with all of the short-term tenancies, right?
Yes, and also with no cause evictions, which is the point that I was making before, is that currently in the Residential Tenancies Act, you ostensibly have these rights to hold your landlord to account if, for example, that, you know, your home isn't up to healthy home standards, or if they are raising your rent more frequently than they should be per the annual increase limitation, or if they are doing inspections without adequate notice or whatever else. But the government reintroducing no-cause evictions undermines all of those rights, because the landlord can kick you out if they believe that you've done one of, if they want to challenge you for trying to enforce your rights on one of those premises.
Yeah.
It's mind-blowing.
But
at the end of the day, the point around rent controls is just that it makes sense to entrench in legislation limitations or predictability as to how much rents can increase.
Yeah.
Because that would be some level of market rationale, which is presently just determined by the whim of those who are in charge.
Yeah. Which, not a great system.
No, as it turns out, kind of exploits and screws over the little guy. Who would have guessed?
Yeah. Well, speaking of human rights, another human right is the right to a stable climate, right?
I don't know
if it's officially codified.
That's such a strong segue, man.
Thanks,
good job.
Thanks. This is show number four. Let's go. And there's been some climate change news this morning.
There has been, yeah. So at 5 a.m. this morning, the government unfortunately didn't give me an embargoed copy. I wonder why. But at 5 a.m. this morning, the government released its emissions reduction plan. So for the uninitiated, under the Zero Carbon Act, as it is typically known, the full name of it is the Climate Change Response Zero Carbon Amendment Act, which was obviously instituted by the Honourable James Shaw as Minister for Climate Change in our first term in relationship with government with Labor in the 2017 to 2020 term. It says we want to get to net neutrality on all of our carbon emissions by 2050.
Yep.
And in order to get there, we're going to set these things called emission budgets, which are going to be like stepping stones to get there.
Yep.
And in order to meet those emission budgets, we're going to need something called emissions reduction plans, which basically give the public and the market transparency about what the government intends to do for us to get to those emissions budgets.
Yep.
Well, let me tell you, after the government saying for a really long time, i.e. the last 6 months, while it was shredding all of these climate policies, notably the likes of the Clean Car Discount and Clean Car Standard, which has seen EVs drop from, I believe off the top of my head, it was 1 in 5 new cars or so, to now, after they've made that change, 1 in 26 new cars are electric vehicles. You can draw quite a strong correlation there.
Definitely. My parents bought an electric car with that discount and would not have done it without it.
Exactly.
You know?
And on top of that, they also shredded public transport subsidies and a bunch of public transport infrastructure that was planned, the likes of rail upgrades, particularly Auckland Light Rail and otherwise. So transport is one of the largest emitters, but it's not the only one. The largest one, of course, is agriculture. Cars and cows, which together make up approximately 70 to 75% of our emissions.
Yeah.
So the frequent argument against, you know, doing anything about our agricultural emissions is that agriculture is the backbone of our economy. Mm-hmm. Just not to challenge anyone's view of that culturally, but just to provide some, like, economic hard facts and data, agriculture accounts for 5% of our GDP, but 50% of our emissions.
Yeah.
It is also currently the only sector of our economy that is not priced for its emissions, which means that every other part of the economy, i.e. in transport and manufacturing or otherwise, everyone else is paying the bill for the lack of action in the agricultural sphere.
Yeah.
And again, we're being completely outpaced by jurisdictions that we tend to compare ourselves with internationally on this stuff.
Definitely.
The government kicked the can down the road on agricultural pricing a little while ago and said that they were going to take away what's called the emissions trading scheme backstop, in which we would just kind of bring it into our regular emissions trading scheme, which is where all other emissions are priced, as opposed to creating this new fandangled thing for
for
agriculture.
Because farmers are special.
And look, to a certain extent, I can agree with the fact that we need, we can all agree with the fact that we need food.
Yeah.
But we also have to agree with the fact that farmers are hit the first and worst by climate change, as recently exemplified by Cyclone Gabrielle, for example.
Yeah.
So actually, one of the best ways to ensure that farmers flourish into the future is to protect the climate necessary to grow that food.
Yeah.
Crazy stuff.
Totally.
But yeah, anyway, long story short, all of these different things that the government's been doing, they've been saying, don't worry, guys, we'll have it sorted in the emissions reduction plan. That emissions reduction plan released this morning shows, unfortunately, there is a lot to worry about, guys.
Yeah.
They do not have it sorted.
Yeah.
In fact, we are now markedly off track to meet our emissions budget 3, and that means that we are off track to meet net carbon neutrality by the year 2050.
Yeah.
The government is basically saying to New Zealanders that it wants to overly rely on the emissions trading scheme, and it said that it wants more certainty in the emissions trading scheme. This is the same government that cut in its most recent budget funding for market governance and integrity of the emissions trading scheme.
Right.
These things do not add up.
Yeah.
It also is saying that it basically doesn't want to stop pollution at the source. It wants to rely on offsets.
Yeah.
And by that, it means particularly Pinus radiata, which is terrible for our biodiversity, but also prompts really massive questions when they are simultaneously saying that they want to protect productive farmland, but also they want all of these conversions to Pinus radiata.
Yeah.
And then just the final point that I would make, although there's so many others to say, is they're also, like, Shane Jones likes to talk a lot about unicorn kisses whenever we're talking about, unicorn kisses when we're talking about demonstrably proven technology like solar panels.
Yeah.
He likes to talk about it as that, and that's apparently...
Wait, what does he mean by unicorn kiss?
Oh, dude, I actually don't know. It transpires that there's a lot of people who are currently in charge of the country who like to throw out a lot of rhetoric, which just tends to be primed to create culture wars so that we're arguing about their rhetoric and not about the actual policy.
Yeah.
But what I think he means is that it's pie in the sky stuff, when again, the reality shows that, in fact...
This is solar panels, which have been around.
And if we were to have the level of solar panels that they do in Australia, which they've got to by virtue of subsidies and intentional government policies, we could shut down the Huntly Power Station tomorrow.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's not deal with that particular fact right now.
Yeah.
The unicorn kisses exist in this emissions reduction plan in the form of the government banking on technology which doesn't currently exist yet, such as carbon capture and methane vaccines.
Yeah.
So what the government is telling all of us is that it really doesn't care about meeting our climate goals, and those goals aren't just words on paper. Those goals very literally are the hard scientific fundamentals necessary for life on Earth as we know it, let alone that economy that Christopher Luxon likes to talk about.
Exactly. So, I mean, a cliche question, but what would you say the most important thing is for people to do then?
I'd say the most important thing for people to do is to be involved. And I want to be really cautious in this by reminding everyone that you don't have to take on the weight of the world.
Yeah.
But what it is really critical, I think, for all of us to do at this point in time in 2024, when we are 40 years on from 1984, the advent of Rogernomics, trickle down economics, and basically the shredding of the social safety net, is to realize in the context of the economic history of this country, every 30 to 40 years ago we have a form of economic transformation.
Yeah.
In the 30s and 40s, subsequent to world wars, that was the creation of the welfare state, the creation of public healthcare, public housing, public education, paid for by higher taxes on those those who had benefited or profited handsomely during a time of hardship for many.
Yep.
As I just said, that was shredded during the 80s and 90s, but now 40 years on from 1984, we are confronted with the dual crises of the highest rates of wealth inequality that we've ever seen on record and the climate crisis.
Yeah.
And that, I think, poses to flip all of that awfulness and dire kind of stuff on its head,
yeah,
an opportunity for us to say this system is either broken or working just as it's intended to in terms of siphoning all the more power and wealth to those at the top.
Yeah.
And that means that we can change that system. And the only thing that has ever changed those systems is regular people engaging in politics. Politics,
yeah,
is not that complicated. It is just about power, it is about who has resources, and it is about who gets to make decisions that impact and shape all of our lives.
Yeah. Definitely.
So do the politics.
Do the politics
or the politics will do you.
Can I get, I think we need that on a t-shirt. I think we need a Green Party
voted
t-shirt that says,
yeah,
that. Fantastic. Well, let's go to a bit of music, and it seems only fitting to play 1 Million Pines by Night Lunch, which is on the SRN top 11 at the moment, top 10 at number 6. So you're on Radio 1, this is Sustainable Sounds, and this is 1 Million Pines by Night Lunch. That's Wallace Lyon by Hard the Unclear on Radio 1. It's Sustainable Sounds. It is just about 8 o'clock. And for the first bit of the show, we've been delighted to be joined by Chloe Swarbrick, which has been awesome. But you've got to go now?
I do. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But we can hang out tomorrow.
Yeah, we can hang
we
out tomorrow.
Can.
We sure can.
I'll be on campus, as my calendar tells me, at approximately 1 p.m. around our Green Party stall.
Yeah.
But I will also, not only me, but two local legends in the form of local Green MPs, Francisco Hernandez,
yep,
and Scott Willis,
and
will
her?
Be. And yes, I was getting to that.
Sorry.
And the one and only Tamitha Paul, Wellington Central MP. So all four of us, four for the price of one. And that price, my friends, is no price.
What a bonanza.
It's crazy. It's
huge.
Crazy. Socialism or something.
Yeah.
But we will be at 4 p.m. at the Bog Irish Bar,
yes,
on George Street.
Beautiful spot.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I'm sorry that it's at such a random time, but that was the time that made sense for all of us, given travel plans and otherwise.
Yeah.
But yeah,
but no, it's
at 4. We'll have
4 o'clock. Yeah, after a lecture, before a lecture, probably not before a lecture.
Stunning.
Yeah, it's going to be great. So 4 o'clock at the Bog. We'll see you there.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, Elliot.
No, thank you so much.
I hope that there was at least two people tuned in.
I've had a bit of feedback.
Our community.
Yeah. All about community building. That's what it's...
I love
that's it.
That's
it. Mate. Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
That was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more of them at r1.co.nz/podcast.